MacCast, Thursday, March 3rd, 2016. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, I think it's probably going to come as no surprise that in today's episode, we have a little bit of follow-up on what's been going on with Apple and the FBI over this encryption case. We're going to talk about that a little bit. I've got some new information about Siri that's pretty exciting. I'm going to talk a little bit about what's happening with the next iPhone. We've been talking about that for a little bit, but this new 4-inch model of iPhone, some new iPad. Apple makes a little apology about breaking something on, possibly something on your computer. So we're going to talk about that. I have a few corrections from the last episode. Going to get into the whole iCloud thing. Found out some interesting information, and some of you asked about iCloud encryption and what's going on there and why is Apple able to turn over encryption or encrypted files from iCloud to the FBI. So we're going to get into the details behind that. Found a cool little trick on Apple TV. Also going to talk a little bit about local storage and Safari. And then I have my thing of the moment, cool little product that I discovered this week. So lots of fun stuff to talk about on today's episode. But before we get into all of it, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Squarespace. So let's face it, right? Building a website, if you've ever had to do that, it can be a time-consuming, a costly, and a frustrating process. Getting into the code, learning JavaScript, HTML, that can, just get complicated. And it can get more complicated as you want to add in new features. And I'm not talking about just the coding part of it. You have to think about mobile designs. You got to think about SEO, search engine optimization, social media, integration, commerce, all that stuff. Here's the deal, though. Squarespace takes away that complexity. With Squarespace, you can get a great-looking website up and running with all the features that you want with an affordable price, and you can do it quickly. And what I like about that is it means you can stay focused on your project, your blog, your team, your business. Whatever you're building that website for, you want to be focused on that. You don't want to be focused on the technicalities of setting up that website. You get to do the things that you want to do, and you get a great-looking website that supports it by using Squarespace. And Squarespace sites really have everything that you need because they give you the hosting. You can get a free domain when you sign up for a year. You get great-looking templates that are already ready for mobile, so they're going to work on any size screen, any device. And you have the ability to fully customize it using drag-and-drop tools. Or if you really want, you can drop straight into the code and go that way as well. So a lot of flexibility, a lot of options, and then they have great additional features like Typekit and Google Fonts. You have image light boxes and photo galleries that you can put into place. You have all the social tools and integration that you need. They have podcast support, website metrics, a whole bunch more, and there's options to do fully integrated e-commerce, professional email from Google, so it really can grow with you and your business or whatever your needs might be. And even better, they let you try it out completely free. You can build a trial site right now at squarespace.com/MacCast. And then when you decide to sign up for Squarespace, just make sure you use the offer code MacCast and you will get 10% off your first purchase. So you're going to save money. You're going to have a great looking website that's going to do everything that you want it to do. Quick and easy. Squarespace, check them out, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. Apple and the FBI. Yeah, we got to get into that a little bit more. If you listen to the last episode of the MacCast, you know my philosophy on this. I'm trying to bring you just the facts, the information as to what's happening in the case. I'm trying to do so without trying to inject too much opinion, which is pretty hard to do. Because I certainly have some opinions on this. I know there's things on both sides, but really the way I'm trying to approach it from the MacCast is the way we always try to approach these things is give you the information about what's going on and then let you kind of decide what you think about it. And I love hearing feedback from you. A lot of you have been sending emails, making comments, and I really appreciate that. I like knowing, you know, this is all about the community and being able to have a voice and talk to each other and sort of work through this, whatever sides of the issues that you might be on. But some of the updates that happened this week, Apple hired a team, actually a kind of a dream team, to help them counter this court order in this case. A guy named Theodore Boutros and Theodore Ted Olson. I think they both go by Ted, but these two guys are the attorneys who argued and won the Supreme Court case fighting California's Prop 8 anti-gay marriage law. They also, I think, first came together when there was the Florida election thing where George Bush during the presidency. So these guys have a lot of experience. They really know what they're doing. They've been out specifically, I think Ted Olson has been doing some different TV interviews and things like that that you may have caught either online or on television, but they're basically starting to lay out their case. And so Apple did file an order to vacate, and it does look, as was thought, that the First Amendment is going to play at least a partial role in their defense. And I thought that was a little bit strange until I dug into a little bit. And basically what's going on is the federal courts have previously ruled that computer code is considered to be speech. And the basic argument, as I understand it, again, I'm not a lawyer, and when you're reading through these documents, there's a lot of legalese, of course. But the Apple's thing is that forcing Apple to write code would therefore be kind of similar to forcing them to basically speak or, you know, have speech. And the First Amendment protects your right to free speech, but it also protects your right not to speak. So I guess if they can argue that the computer code that the FBI wants them to write is speech, that the order would be forcing them to speak, and that would be a violation of their First Amendment rights. So that's how the First Amendment is coming into play. Now, this order to vacate that Apple filed, this was a document, I want to say it was 36 pages long. And yes, I read through the entire thing myself. There were a lot of reports online sort of summarizing these things, and that's going to be what I'm going to do for you. But if you want to, I mean, you can find Apple's order to vacate online and you can read through it for yourself. But it basically reiterated many of Apple's previous arguments. So there's like a whole opening statement. But I found the most interesting part of the document, the arguments part. But in the document, and I'm just going to summarize for you kind of some of the key points. One of the things I really thought was great was Apple gave the proposed software rewrite of iOS that the government wants them to create a name. They're calling it GovOS. So I guess if Apple takes this to the Supreme Court and ultimately has to write this version of iOS for the FBI, they're going to dub it GovOS. So we'll have iOS, OS 10, TVOS, GovOS, and I guess WatchOS. And of course, immediately on Twitter, and I thought this was kind of clever too, some sites came out and said, oh, maybe they should call it FBIOS, since the FBI are the ones that are wanting Apple to create this software. But basically they're saying, you know, the FBI wants to compel Apple to make its products more insecure. And in Apple's mind, they reiterated that effectively they feel that's being forced to create a backdoor into the software, because once this stuff is created, it could be used by the good guys, but it could also be used by the bad guys as well. So they kind of reiterated that stance. They also reiterated the concern that once they've created the software for the U.S. government, that they would be asked to do it over and over again in other cases, and also by other foreign governments. They also said that, you know, this doesn't necessarily solve the problem that you're trying to solve of tracking down criminals, because if we create this backdoor, we create this software, the criminals are just going to figure out how to do this in other ways. They're going to be driven further underground. They're going to use techniques and technologies that are developed in other countries that the U.S. government can't compel in the way that they're compelling Apple. So you're kind of just going to force these guys into darker corners was part of their argument. And the interesting thing about that part of their argument was that they used FBI Director James Comey's own article. He wrote a piece called Going Dark about exactly this, the fact that these new technologies and things are allowing criminals and the bad guys they're trying to track down to, you know, basically hide themselves better. And so Apple used his own article in the order to vacate as kind of evidence of, hey, this is what's going to happen if this kind of goes through. They also went on to state, which I think is going to be the crux of their case, that the government's request has no support in law and it actually violates the Constitution. So they're going to be using the Constitution, and we're going to get into, I'll get into some of the details of Apple's case in a second, but I just want to give you kind of an overview of what they're saying in this order to vacate. And they reiterated that they do have strong support for the efforts of law enforcement and pursuing justice against terrorists and other criminals. You know, this is not in Apple's mind about not wanting to comply and work with law enforcement. And again, they cited that they gave the FBI the unencrypted data from iCloud.com backups that they did have on this phone. And if you remember from the last episode, the problem was is that those backups stopped on October 19th, 2015. The San Bernardino shooting happened in December. So the FBI is saying, well, we kind of want to get the data that's on the phone that was generated between October 19th and the time of the incident, which I think is a reasonable thing. You know, they're trying to track down every lead. They're trying to figure out, you know, what possible other things might be on the phone that they could do. And that's just doing their due diligence. That's the job that they're employed to do. And unfortunately, the fact that the phone is encrypted is causing some issues for them, which is why they're pursuing, kind of forcing Apple to help them be able to crack the device. So in laying out Apple's case in this document, what they did is they cited congressional law, something called the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act, CALEA. And they said it defines when a company, or sorry, this document defines when a company would be required to help law enforcement execute electronic surveillance and when they would not. And they said it basically states that a company has no obligation to decrypt data when the company doesn't have the decryption key. And that is true in this case. But you need to keep in mind that the FBI is not specifically asking in this case that Apple decrypt the data. So even if Apple thinks this is kind of the same thing, it's going to be interesting to see how they make that argument, because the FBI is not asking them to decrypt data. They're asking Apple to disable some of the controls so that the FBI can brute force hack, try and guess the password on the device using computers and other systems. It also talks about the fact that there was a proposed CALEA 2, I guess, that would expand this law's scope by mandating that companies install backdoors into their products. But ultimately, that didn't get any support from the president. So I think it's kind of stalled out. I don't know that it's totally dead. And I think that's one of the things that Apple is very concerned about with this case, possibly setting some precedent and maybe allowing something like CALEA 2 to go through. So that's mentioned in the document as part of their counterargument, saying, look, if we're asked to do this, it's going to go against the CALEA Act that already exists. They also say that by creating government OS or Gov OS, it would take 6 to 10 Apple engineers 2 to 4 weeks to actually develop the code. I just found that interesting because now we kind of have an understanding of what Apple feels the effort is going to be. And one of the counterarguments that they can make is that the request could be unduly burdensome. I don't know that the actual man hours would be burdensome. And as I mentioned, I think last week in the original order, Apple will get compensated for any cost that would be involved. So there's not going to be a financial burden to the company. The government has to pay for this version of government OS that they would be asked to write. But they did say if a case came up based on the operating system. So one of the arguments that they're trying to make, it looks like, in terms of why this would be a burden, and this actually relates to some counter arguments that the FBI has made, and people have said, well, the FBI is only asking for the OS to be created for this one device in this one instance, and Apple can destroy the operating system afterwards. Apple is actually using that as a counter argument in this, because they're using that, it seems to me, to kind of generate this idea that, hey, this is actually going to create a burden for us in a couple different ways. And one of those ways is that if a case went to trial, if Apple wrote this, the FBI cracked the device and then found some evidence that they wanted to use in a trial. And again, remember, I don't know that there's necessarily going to be a trial in this case, because as far as we know, and the FBI has confirmed that they believe these are the only two suspects, the suspects were killed during the event. You know, there was a chase afterwards, and both suspects are dead. So assuming there's no other suspects, there's not really going to be a case. But one of the concerns is, if something happens and there is a trial and any evidence gathered through the method of Apple allowing the government to get into this device, if any of that comes to light, then the code that Apple wrote and the methodology has to be turned over to the defense, and it has to be evaluated by a third party. They basically have to have the opportunity to show that the prosecution and Apple didn't do anything funky. They didn't mess with any of the evidence. So at that point, the technique and the method and the code would get out into the world. And that is what Apple's very concerned about happening. So there is a viable way, there is a possible way where this could get out. It's not that Apple can just turn around and destroy it. And even if they did turn around and destroy the code, Apple is also making the argument that recreating the code every single time a new request comes in, that would actually really be a burden on Apple. They'd have to, again, take 6 to 10 engineers, they'd have to start all over, rewrite the software, and they'd have to do that for every request. So Apple's argument is that there is going to be a burden because of this. They also say that the All Writs Act is being too broadly applied by the court order. And this was the original basis for the court order being generated. So they're saying, hey, you know, that's not really what the All Writs Act is, and you're applying it really broadly. And that's that 200-year-old act that was the genesis for the court order. They again argue that the order would create an undue burden on their developers if they have to keep rewriting the code. And it would also, another way they're saying this is going to be a burden is, hey, if we don't, you know, if we keep the code around, we lock it in Apple's secure, safe vault, we don't let it out into the world, we keep it in case the next time one of these court orders comes in, we can comply with it. There's a burden for us to actually defend that code. We've got to kind of vet people who are going to have access to it. We've got to deal with it. We've got to keep it really safe. And that's going to cause a new burden for the company. It's something we don't have to do today, and this would require us to do that. So that seems to be another one of the arguments. And then the last two were the constitutional arguments. We already talked a little bit about their First Amendment argument that, you know, if code is treated as speech, you can't compel us to actually make statements or make speech that we don't want to make. That would be a violation of our First Amendment. And then they also say that the Fifth Amendment comes into play because Apple, being a private party with a very limited connection to the case, that under the due process laws, they are protected against any arbitrary action by the government. And that one got a little complex for me. Again, there's a lot of legalese in there, but I think Apple's basically saying, look, you know, we have the right, because we're just a company and we're far removed from this case, we have a limited connection to it. Under due process, you can't sort of make us do things. The government can't force us to do this, to write this code. And so in a nutshell, that's kind of how Apple is laying out their defense or their counter argument to this court order. Now, I think last time, too, I also mentioned that I really felt there's going to be some fallout from this case, that Apple is going to go and they're going to try and start locking down devices and the encryption and the stuff in ways where orders like this, they wouldn't even be able to comply with them. And we started to get reports this week that that is exactly what is happening, that Apple's already working on solutions that would make it impossible for them to bypass iPhone security in the way that the FBI is currently proposing in this court order. They reportedly hired a guy named Frederick Jacobs, who is the a developer responsible for a secure chat app called Signal. And he's supposedly going to be working now on the Core OS security team. So they're already starting to bring in some, you know, pretty smart people in the area of encryption and putting them on the OS team. And really all that's going to mean, though, is that in the future, there's going to have to be other ways and techniques that are going to have to be developed. And so security is always and always will be this kind of cat and mouse game, right? Apple tightens up the encryption, or a company tightens up encryption. And you're right, this isn't just an Apple thing. But encryption gets tightened. Government and law enforcement have to figure out new ways to be able to do surveillance and investigations and all that sort of stuff. So this is not anything new. This has been going on for centuries, longer than that. And as new technologies come into play that change the parameters of the game, you have to find new solutions. And that is going to continue to happen. Another thing that happened this past week was there was a 5-hour congressional hearing where both Apple's chief counsel, Bruce Sewell, and FBI Director James Comey testified. And after the hearing, there was a 2-page formal objection to the original court order filed by Apple. And what was interesting about this was there's already a hearing scheduled for Apple's objection to the court order, but apparently they need to file a formal objection, because if they don't do that, it could be interpreted as Apple waiving their right to an appeal. So obviously they don't want that to happen. So after this congressional hearing, they did file this 2-page formal objection, just basically saying, look, we are going to fight this. We're going to appeal this court order. And so this is definitely not over. We're still hearing a lot more about this case, and it's going to go on for a while, unless it just gets thrown out. But I would imagine if the order gets nullified, that the FBI could come back and again, long drawn out legal stuff. I generally don't like to talk about legal stuff on the MacCast. If you've been a listener for a long time, you know that. And that's just because it gets so complicated and in the weeds. But hopefully by doing these little segments, by just trying to stick to the facts, we've broken it down a little bit and make it a little bit more understandable. And if I've gotten anything wrong, if you have corrections for me, please email me. If you think my understanding of something is a little bit off, I'm happy to hear that. Or if you're an expert in any one of these areas and just want to chime in, shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. One other little bit of fallout that I found I think was interesting is, if you remember last week, I think we talked about the fact that the San Bernardino County IT people did have access to what's called multiple device management software, but they decided department by department whether or not to deploy that. And this software lets an IT person basically manage all of the corporate iOS devices. And this phone that's in question, in case you didn't know it, is a work-issued cell phone. It was issued to one of the shooters in the San Bernardino case. And had the software been installed on it, they could do things like unlock it remotely. They have the ability. Well, it wasn't installed. But the interesting fallout that's coming after this case, and this may have already been planned by Apple, but it was noted that in iOS 9.3, now in both the unlock and the about screens, if your device is being managed by multiple device management software, there's now going to be a message indicating that to the end user. So there's a little message that says this iPhone is managed by your organization, and you'll see that on the lock screen. You'll see that in the about screen as well. So just another sort of privacy thing to let you know, hey, this is a corporate issued cell phone and they do have access to data and your information. And if they get a court order, they could be compelled to actually give that information and data over, which is kind of what's happening in this case. So if you're concerned about security and privacy and you have a work issued device under multiple device management, you probably don't want to put anything you don't want getting out on that device. And we're going to talk a little bit more a little bit later about iCloud encryption and security of cloud backups. So stay tuned for that. But that's kind of the latest update on what's going on with the Apple FBI case. I was so happy to hear this next story come out. Finally, we are going to get, or it's looking like we're going to get, Siri in OS X. I don't know why it's taken Apple so long, but it is coming, reportedly. Siri will live in the menu bar as a little icon, and it will have a customizable keyboard shortcut to activate it. The user interface looks like it's going to be similar to the one on the iPhone, so you get that little colorful voice pattern bar when you activate it. And when you activate it, it is going to appear in a small window in the upper right-hand corner of your screen. They're also saying that they're going to have the Siri hands-free voice activation. I'm trying to very hard not to say that phrase. I think we all often substitute the Hola Siri option. So you know what I'm talking about. You'll be able to do that when your Mac is connected to power. And it's the update is going to be part of OS 10.12, which is, I guess, currently codenamed Fuji. Apple is using locations in California, I believe, as their naming convention for the releases. So we don't know what the release name is going to be yet, but the code name is Fuji. And we will possibly see the feature shown off at WWDC in June. I think that seems very likely. We also got a little bit more information about what we might see in 10.12 in the Photos application. This came from a report from Mac Takahara. They say that Apple is going to be finally bringing back some of the lost iPhoto features, and that the version of Photos in 10.12 will basically be in line with iPhoto 9.6.1. So that's good news for a lot of people. They don't mention any specifics, though, of what features might be there, but some of the missing features that we don't have right now in Photos that were in iPhoto 9.6.1 are things like brush correction, selective brightness adjustments on images, the ability to flag images, and the ability to edit the photo EXIF data. And if you remember, there was also some features for doing batch file name changes, along with the ability to do batch file name changes with incrementing information. So, you know, number 1, 2, 3, that's not in Photos currently. And there was also that feature where you could reverse the sort order when you're looking at your photos. So in the Photos app, you can only go from the oldest at the top to the newest at the bottom. You used to be able to reverse that in iPhoto. So hopefully those are all the features that are returning in Photos in 10.12, and we probably won't know for sure until we see Apple show it off at WWDC in June. Couple quick Apple TV updates to let you know about. Apple added a new category in the purchase section of Apple TV this past week. You can now get a not on this Apple TV section so that you can see, hey, I've purchased an app, it now has an Apple TV version, but it's not installed on my Apple TV. You'll be able to quickly see that. And there was also a software update if you have an older third generation Apple TV issued. 7.2.1 came out. It's mainly a security update. It patches some issues that could expose some iCloud data, also could show the Wi-Fi networks of a person who had previously connected to your Apple TV. And it stops a potential exploit that could allow malicious code execution or the reading of an app's managed preferences. So if you have an older third-gen Apple TV, you're going to want to run your software update if you don't have it set up to go automatically to grab this one. Interesting development in the 4-inch iPhone rumors. If you remember, to date, we've been struggling with the name of the 4-inch iPhone. It started out, I think, way back when as the iPhone 6C, and then they said, no, it's going to be an iPhone 5SE. Well, this week, apparently, the latest rumor in the name is that they're going to be dropping the 5, and it's going to be simply called the iPhone SE. And I think it's kind of smart for them to drop association with a specific generation. My issue with the 5SE name was always the fact that by adding the 5, it's going to make consumers think, oh, that's an older iPhone. The current generation is iPhone 6S and 6S Plus. 5SE, oh, that's an older model. I'm not getting the same. And when you look at what the rumored specs are supposed to be, it's lining up to be mostly in line with an iPhone 6S. Basically, an iPhone 6S with a 4-inch screen and no 3D touch. It's going to have an A9X and an M9 coprocessor, so the same processors that are in the iPhone 6S. It originally was rumored to have an 8-megapixel EyeSight camera, which would be the same camera that is currently in the iPhone 5S, but Ming-Chi Kuo said this week that it's actually going to be the 12-megapixel camera that is in the iPhone 6S. So that's coming in line. It's going to have NFC with Apple Pay support. It's going to come in 16-gigabyte and 64-gigabyte capacities, and it's rumored to be priced at between $400 to $500 US. So it's going to be that entry-level iPhone. A lot of people want a 4-inch model, so I think it's going to be a really nice bump to iPhone sales, and the timing of it coming out, I think, makes sense. Now, some reports are now saying that the announcement is going to happen a little bit later than was first reported. Originally, it was thought the announcement was going to happen at a special event on March 15th. Now the rumors are pointing to the week of March 21st. Apple typically does it on a Tuesday, so March 22nd is the new date, although I still am seeing some reports claiming the original date of March 15th with sales starting on the 18th. So the date may be a little bit in flux, but expect to see some sort of an announcement later this month. And as far as the physical design of the 4-inch iPhone, it is kind of a cross between the 6S and the 5S. It's going to be more flat on the edges, so it's going to not be as rounded as the 6S on the sides, so more flat like the 5S. But it is going to have a slightly curved glass, although some of the reports are saying not as curved on the edges as the 6S. The bottom ports and speakers look to be almost identical to the 5S, so all of the speaker hole and mic placements along with the 3.5 millimeter jack are the same, and the sleep-wake button is going to be moved to the side like it is on the 6 and the 6S designs. So kind of this little hybrid between the two, but I think it's shaping up to be a really nice addition to the iPhone lineup, and it looks like it is going to replace the 5S. So the 5S will kind of be phased out, and what you're going to have in the lineup is the iPhone SE, the iPhone 6S, and the iPhone 6S Plus, at least until the iPhone 7 comes out. Another thing that's expected to be announced at this announcement has been this rumored update to the iPad Air, the iPad Air 3. But this week we're hearing reports that it may not be called that. It might be a 9.7-inch iPad Pro. And that makes a little bit of sense because the specs that we've been hearing about are almost identical to the current iPad Pro. So really the only difference is the size, being in a 9.7-inch form factor versus 12.9. It's going to have an A9X processor with 4 gigabytes of RAM, updated display technology. It's going to come with Apple Pencil support. Again, no 3D touch, but there's no 3D touch on the iPad Pro either. It's going to have that same quad stereo speaker design, so 4 different speakers with the feature where if you cover up a speaker, it's going to adjust the audio pattern so that you're getting the best possible audio out of the speakers. There's also a new rumor that it may get an upgraded camera, so it might have a better camera than the iPad Pro, that 12 megapixel EyeSight camera that Apple has been using. It's going to come in the same colors and storage capacities as the iPad Pro, so 32 gigabyte, 128 gigabyte Wi-Fi, and 128 gigabyte cellular. The prices, though, are going to be closer to an iPad Air. It will have the smart connector with a smaller keyboard cover. So for all intents and purposes, really a 9.7-inch iPad Pro. So I think the naming makes sense. And if that turns out to be the case, What most are expecting is Apple is going to have a simplified iPad lineup, starting with the iPad Mini 4, and then a 9.7 or a 12.9-inch iPad Pro. And then on the entry level, you'd still have the iPad Air 2 as the 9.7-inch entry-level iPad. And then the iPad Mini 2 and the original iPad Air would reportedly be phased out. And again, because Apple has been seeing declining iPad sales over the last few quarters, or several quarters, really, I think it makes sense for them to kind of consolidate the line. You're really going to have iPad Mini, iPad Pro in two different sizes, and then an entry-level 9.7-inch iPad. Simplifies the line, makes a lot of sense, and so I'm kind of buying into this rumor. It'll be interesting to see what actually happens at the event, but I like this, the thought behind this. And so that's the lineup we should kind of be seeing on March 22nd. There's also been those rumors, just to reiterate, that Apple may have some additional Apple Watch designs, some new bands, some new combinations, that sort of thing. And that'll kind of round out the special event for March. And then following up for iPhone, it's expected in the fall, we will have an update to the iPhone 6S and 6S Plus with the iPhone 7. iPhone 7 Plus, there may be some new naming. We're going to talk about that in a minute, but just some things on the iPhone 7 rumors. The French blog, Nowhere Else, claims to have the frame part, basically, for the iPhone 7. Now, this is a little bit suspicious because the part that they were showing off measures 5.2 inches, not 4.9 or 5.5 like the 6S and 6S Plus, and it also has a 3.5 millimeter headphone jack hole. And all the rumors to date have seemed to indicate that the iPhone 7 is going to be ditching that in favor of the Lightning connector. So those two things raise suspicion, but the thought of Apple sort of bumping up the size of the smaller iPhone to 5.2 inches, I don't know that that's out of the realm of possibility. They may go a little bit larger, and I don't know how I feel about that. I think a lot of people won't like that idea, but the marketplace has kind of been indicating that people like the larger form factors. Some other iPhone 7 rumors we've been hearing about, that it's going to be a millimeter thinner than the iPhone 6S. So basically the same thickness as an iPod Touch. That is really thin. I mean, that's a big difference in the thinness of the iPhone. We're hearing that it may not be waterproof, something that I was not happy to hear. Apple's been increasing the water resistance of the iPhone. The 6S and 6S Plus has a pretty good water resistance, and many were hoping that Apple would finally move to a completely waterproof phone. That rumor seems to be in question at this point. Now, despite getting a millimeter thinner, we are hearing that it will finally again have a flush-mounted camera. I think that does a lot for the design, and that may be being made possible by Apple's acquisition of Lynx, which is also the company that's rumored to be bringing the dual lens system possibly to the Plus model. So flush mounted camera, stereo speakers, a thinner Lightning port. And if that sounds a little bit strange, it did to me the first time I heard it. What they're really talking about is a smaller cutout. So if you look at the bottom of your iPhone 6S right now, or 6, you'll notice that there's kind of this ring, this silver ring around that connector. In the renderings and the images, the leaked images that I've seen, that seems to be going away, and it's just going to be a smaller, thinner slot. And it's also being reported that TSMC is currently doubling up their 16 nanometer chip production. And most of the reports seem to think that is because they're getting ready to make the new A10 processors for the iPhone 7 production. So they're kind of getting ready to go on production. And then another little rumor regarding the larger size iPhone, the 7 Plus model, that may get a new name. It may be called the iPhone Pro. And it's not clear at this point whether it's going to be a replacement of the Plus or if there's going to be an additional model on the higher end. Some people have been saying that the dual lens system might be reserved for a special higher end version of the 7 Plus, and maybe that is what would end up being called the iPhone Pro. And what's interesting to me about this rumor as well is they're saying it's going to be called the iPhone Pro, not the iPhone 7 Pro. So Apple kind of dropping the number. And when I thought about that and I thought about this other rumor, you know, Apple having an iPhone SE, if they go to Pro for the larger iPhone and they have the 4-inch iPhone at SE, it seems to me it would open up the possibility of completely losing the numbering scheme altogether. And they could simply go with iPhone SE, iPhone, and iPhone Pro. And I kind of like that simplification. I don't know if Apple's marketing team would, because, again, having the number gives you a nice distinction between which model, and we wouldn't have to do, iPhone, you know, 8th generation or iPhone Pro 2nd generation, that sort of thing. But I like the more simplified naming. I always have, but that's just my personal preference. So what do you think about that? You know, could Apple move to iPhone SE, iPhone, iPhone Pro as the new naming scheme if these rumors all pan out? Shoot me some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. If you had some networking issues and you use Ethernet over the past week or so, you were not alone. And guess what? It wasn't a problem with your computer or your network. It really wasn't even your fault. Apple came out this week and said, you know, sorry, we broke your Ethernet. Apparently what happened is they pushed out an update that caused connectivity issues for some Mac users. To see if you were impacted, what you can do is you can check the version number of something called the incompatible kernel extension configuration file. Yeah, a long name for a complicated thing that basically is a security, I guess this is a security thing. Apple can push out this kernel extension configuration file and basically disable a port for security reasons. And they did it accidentally. So if you go into your Apple menu under About This Mac and then click on, in the window that pops up, the system report, bring up the system report and go to the software section on the left-hand side and select installations. And then you can search the list on the right for this incompatible kernel extension configuration data file. And there's several of them, but what you're looking for is you want to see if there's one that says its version number is 3.28.1. And if you have that there, then you do need to update. Now, the update should have already happened automatically. It should have been applied. But if it didn't, there is a terminal command that you can run. And the process is detailed in an Apple support article that I will link to in the show notes at maccast.com. But if you have this issue, it would be pretty obvious, because if you're hooked into Ethernet and that's how you have connectivity to your network, your network wouldn't be working. Now, some people might not notice it if they also have access to a Wi-Fi network, because it would just simply, you know, fail over to your Wi-Fi network. So you probably do want to check just to make sure that you're not impacted by this. But again, Apple has already updated it and pushed out the update and apologized for doing that. But with that, that is it for the news for this week. Now I have a small correction to make from the last episode of the MacCast. Jill wrote me to point out something that I said that could have caused, I think, a little bit of confusion concerning John McAfee. And this was when we were talking about the Apple versus FBI case. McAfee had come on a couple different outlets and said that he was volunteering for free to help the FBI get at the data that they want. And during that segment, I referred to him as John McAfee of McAfee Antivirus. When I said that, I was meaning simply that he was the creator of the original app. And I realized from Jill's email and just after kind of listening to how it was said that some people may have interpreted that as him still being part of the company, and that is not technically accurate. He left the company in 1994, and the company was later sold in 2010 to Intel, and the current product is actually marketed as Intel Security, not McAfee Antivirus, or I think they have a couple of other products in the line at this point. So just wanted to clear up any confusion there. And then another small thing that I also mentioned during the segment was that we didn't know whether or not the phone was locked with a 4-digit passcode, a 6-digit passcode, or a longer random one. The FBI hasn't kind of divulged that information. They haven't disclosed it, at least as far as I know. And I still think that is accurate. But I think I may have also alluded to the fact that maybe the FBI doesn't even know whether or not it has a 4-digit, 6-digit or longer random password. And Carlos emailed me with a screenshot and pointed out, and I had totally forgotten about this, that if you have a 4-digit or a 6-digit numeric code as your passcode, then the lock screen, when you go to that to enter the password, only displays the number pad. If you have a longer alphanumeric passcode, you actually get a text box and a full keyboard display. So the FBI would definitely know if it was a longer one. But again, I think they still have not disclosed that information. So just a little few corrections and follow-up from the last episode of the MacCast. Now, another thing kind of came out related to this case that I think is important to know, and it was actually something that confused me a little bit as well. I've received a few emails about the iCloud data. So one of the facts in the case is that when the FBI came to Apple to ask for help with this case, Apple did give the FBI some iCloud backups and unencrypted iCloud backups from the iPhone in the San Bernardino case. And as we mentioned earlier, the backups run through, I think, October 19th, 2015. And the question has come up, and it was also a question in my mind, that isn't the iCloud data encrypted? And Apple is very specific in their support documents and in their information about the fact that when you're doing iCloud backups, the data is encrypted in transit, so going from your phone to Apple servers, and that it is also encrypted on Apple servers. And obviously with the iPhone itself, Apple is saying we can't decrypt the data on the iPhone. So the question becomes, well, if you can't decrypt the data in the iPhone, how come Apple can decrypt the data in iCloud? Or for people who are concerned about the privacy of their information, why can Apple actually decrypt the data that's in iCloud? What is the difference? And the difference is where the keys for that encryption data are stored. So yes, when you set a passcode lock on your iPhone, all the data on the device itself is encrypted. When you upload stuff to iCloud, it's all encrypted, but it's encrypted in different ways and with different keys. So on the iPhone itself, the keys are actually made by mixing the passcode data with the data from the phone's unique ID. And the unique ID from the phone is actually set during manufacturing. It is part of the hardware itself. And I think I'm accurate in saying that the process of mixing those two, mixing the passcode that you pick along with this hardware unique ID, that's a process known as salting. Basically, you're mixing two things together, and then those two things, I believe, are then hashed or mixed up and jumbled and encrypted and stored on the device itself. And that key together is the thing that you need to unlock your iPhone. So what happens when you enter the password, essentially, is, or you enter the passcode, is the system will take that entry, mix it again with the unique ID from the hardware, hash it in the same way, and then they'll compare what was originally stored when you set up the password on the iPhone to the value that it got using the same process. And if the two things match, then the iPhone knows, okay, that's a valid passcode. I can unlock the phone. So that's the process that goes on. And that unique ID is permanently assigned to the device, and only one unique ID per device. And Apple does not know that unique ID. So therefore, even if they had your passcode, if they don't have the physical device, they can't get at that information. So they can't decrypt it. So the outside the encryption process, the UID, the unique ID, is not available. For iCloud, it's a little bit different. What happens is the data is backed up and protected in transit by SSL encryption, 128-bit. It's also encrypted on the server. And in case you're wondering what SSL encryption is, that's the same thing. If you see the little green lock in your browser when you're, say, accessing your banking system, that's the same kind of encryption. That's encrypting the data messages as they go between your Mac and a remote server, either a web server or, in the case of iCloud, iCloud's servers. And then once the data is transmitted securely to Apple's servers, Apple then does encrypt the backup of your iPhone data on the server. But in that case, it's keys that Apple generates and stores themselves on their servers. So they're keys that Apple does have access to. So they can then decrypt the data using those same keys. Now, within that, Apple also does say that there are certain kinds of data that they can't decrypt from iCloud backups. And those are things like Wi-Fi passwords, Apple's keychain, which is the collection of your passwords that you may have saved with Safari, say, for example, and are syncing through the Apple keychain, and any passwords from third-party services. Those are decrypted locally on the device before they're packaged into your backup, and Apple does not have the keys for those. But any other data that you store in iCloud that's in your backup, so say your contacts or your text messages that you've saved in your backups or any of that kind of data, they can decrypt, and they do decrypt it when presented sometimes with a valid court order. Now, it's important to know that they do not always do it, as in some cases, like recently there was a request for an order in New York City that was denied. But for a valid request that is approved by a judge, if they're asked to provide that data with a valid court order, they will sometimes do that. Sometimes they push back, sometimes they don't. It's taken on a case-by-case basis. But that's what's going on. That's why they can decrypt that data. So some people have asked, well, then why doesn't Apple actually encrypt the iCloud backups locally, say using the same key that you would have on your iPhone before they upload it to iCloud? That way they wouldn't have the keys. They would not be able to decrypt the iCloud data, and it sort of takes themselves out of that equation. And the simple answer for that is that, I guess the question really is, why does Apple see encrypting data on the device differently than they see decrypting data in the cloud? And the answer to that is that for local encryption, the stuff that's on the device, they see that as a way to protect your device if it's lost or stolen. So if a criminal somehow were to get physical access to your device, they can't go in there and read your emails and read your text messages and get data off the device, potentially being able to do identity theft or steal your money or any of that sort of stuff. So it's kind of to protect that device itself. With a backup of your iCloud data that goes to Apple's servers, Apple really sees their role as, hey, we need to be able to assist you in recovering this data if you need to. So if you've forgotten your password or your device gets stolen, they have to be able to do that. Another factor is they have the iCloud service where I can log into my iCloud account on Apple servers and I can view certain bits of that iCloud data. In order to get access to that, Apple, of course, has to be able to decrypt that to be able to display it to you once you're logged into your iCloud account. So because iCloud is a service that they're providing, they need some additional access to that information so that they can provide that service to you. It's a small distinction, but when you think about it, it is something that seems reasonable. You lose your device, you want to be able to get a backup of your data. You forget your password, you want Apple and their service people to be able to reset it so that you can get your data back. Now, there's some other things that are a little bit different. So if Apple took that different approach and encrypted it locally, and then there was a problem, you forgot your password, you'd call up Apple support and they'd say, look, we're sorry. We can't get your data back because we don't know the keys. And that's what would happen to me, for example, if I forgot my 1Password password. My 1Password data is encrypted with my 1Password login. And if I ever forget that 1Password, AgileBits is not going to be able to help me recover my password data. So Apple could go the other route. And as a matter of fact, there's been some reports this week that they're considering possibly changing iCloud encryption so that the key is kept with you. But that could cause some complications. Apple could take another approach, a service like CrashPlan. So you know that I use CrashPlan for my offsite backup. Out of the box, their default way of doing it is they do have copies of the keys so that they could help me recover my data if I ever lost my password. But they do offer some other options where I can use a key that is generated by me and stored locally, but is using one of their algorithms or their systems, or I could go even further and opt to use completely keys that are custom, ones that I use. But they do warn you, if you change that system, the chance of recovery if you lose your keys is completely null. You can't get your data back if you forget those keys. So there's a balance here between privacy and security, and Apple is opting to go one route with one system and one route with another system. Now, if you don't like that, if you're worried about Apple with a court order potentially being able to get to your iCloud backups, then you maybe want to not back up your data from your iOS devices to iCloud. And Apple does provide that option. You always have the option to not use iCloud backups and to simply back up locally using iTunes. And the way you would do that is you connect your device, you launch to your Mac using the Lightning to USB cable, you open up iTunes, you go select your device, and then under backups in the summary tab, there is a to this computer option. If you turn that on, then that will make that backup to your computer. Now, it's important to note that when that backup is made, it's not encrypted. So if you're not using something like File Vault or whole disk encryption, if someone had physical access to your computer, they could potentially still get at that backup data. Apple also does provide an option locally to encrypt that data. So in the same area, there's a checkbox that says encrypt iPhone backup. It will ask you to choose a password. You'll set that. And then when you pull a backup locally, it will encrypt that backup. Now, once again, you've set that password. Do not forget it, because if you ever forget it, you will not be able to restore your local backup. And there is nothing that Apple or anybody else could do to do that for you. So just be aware of that. You can always go the manual route if you don't want Apple to have the data. And we'll have to keep an eye. You know, Apple may change this policy. I hope maybe they take more of the crash plan route and give us some options. Say, look, you can have us encrypt your data and we'll have the keys and just know that we'll be able to access that information if we need to. Or, hey, you want to take this other option? We'll let you encrypt it locally. You'll set the password. We won't have the keys, but just note if there's ever a problem, you forget the password, we're not going to be able to help you in that case. And if you're willing to take that risk for the higher level of privacy protection, then that's your option. It would be nice to have the option. Right now, we really don't, beyond just doing the local backup thing that I just described. But I think this is a good conversation worth having, because I think a lot of people didn't really understand, you know, why can Apple decrypt that iCloud data? So that is why. Here's a cool little thing that I learned about the Apple TV, thanks to Tony, that this is the new Apple TV, Apple's fourth generation latest Apple TV. Tony emailed me and he said that he recently got an app for his Apple TV that said if you placed the app icon on the home screen in the top row, that its functionality would change. It would somehow open up magic additional functionality. And to be more accurate, it's kind of enhanced when it is in the top row, and certain applications have this capability. I don't know that there's any easy way to tell beyond, like Tony did, reading the app description, but what's going on here is Apple has a feature in the Apple TV called the top shelf, and it is the row of information that is above the top row of icons in the new Apple TV tvOS interface. So what happens is when you place an app in there, and you can see this with Apple's own apps, the movies app, the TV shows app, when you select that icon in the top row, the content in the top shelf area, that area above that, changes and can display certain information. So for like movies and TV shows, they show you, I think, your recent purchases, some of the top shows on the store, and you can navigate up to that area and actually interact with it. But apparently third-party apps can also take advantage of that space. It just seems like most of them don't for some reason. But if you have an app like Netflix, for example, if you place the Netflix app in the top row in the Apple TV interface, you'll notice when you select it, you get stuff like the trending shows and new shows that they've added to Netflix. And you can actually go up, navigate, click on one of those items, and jump directly to it. HBO also has support for the top shelf. Using that app, if you have in the top row, they let you jump into specific categories like documentaries or comedies or HBO series. So really, to kind of figure out if you have an app that supports the feature, the easiest way to figure it out, I think, is to just move it into the top row and then see what happens. So to do that, you can actually rearrange icons on the Apple TV interface by pressing and holding on the play pause button until the icon wiggles, and then you can use the directional pad or the trackpad to move it to whatever location you want. So you just simply move it up into the top row. You press play, pause again. That will drop the icon in the top row and stop the wiggling. And then you can see if it has additional functionality. Another benefit of moving icons around is that when you press and hold and it's wiggling, if you press the play, pause button again, it will actually delete the app. And now as I'm saying this, I realized earlier I said dropping the icon to drop it in place, you press play, pause. Don't do that because it will delete the app. I think it'll actually give you a prompt and say, do you want to delete this app? The way to drop the icon into place is to click the trackpad to actually put it into place. So just be aware of that little difference. All right. So little tip there on the Apple TV about the top shelf functionality. And thank you to Tony for emailing me about that. Another email I received this week came from Rick, and he was asking me about something called local storage in Safari. And the way he noticed it was he was browsing around in his library folder inside the home folder, and he noticed that in Safari there was a folder called local storage. And he said, hey, what is this local storage stuff? And more importantly, hey, it's taking up some data on my Mac. Can I safely delete it? And Rick, what this feature is part of not just Safari, but the latest web standards in general. So browsers can have an option to store data in a local database file. In the past, they've always kind of had the ability to store a little bit of data in your cookies. And a lot of us are familiar with browser cookies and kind of how they work. This is essentially the same kind of thing, but they can actually store a lot more data. I think by default, most browsers allow up to 5 megabytes, and they can request more. So sometimes you might go to a website and it says, hey, this website wants to use local storage and they want to use up to 10 megabytes or 20 megabytes. And you have to kind of click OK and you can approve it. But it's basically just a little local database file. And what they'll use it for is different kinds of settings. Some actually websites will have an offline option, so they can actually build a certain functionality that'll work offline when you're not connected to the internet, and they'll use local storage for that. But there's various purposes. So that's what the local storage is. And what you came upon in the Finder was just the place where Apple actually stores those little database files for the Safari browser. And again, they'll be the same thing for a Chrome browser or Firefox if you're using that. But sticking with Safari, the way you can actually safely remove that data, I think you probably could just delete it out of the folder, but really the proper way to remove it is from within the Safari preferences themselves. So you open up Safari, you go under preferences, and then you want to go to the privacy tab. And you'll probably have to wait a second, but there's an area that says remove all website data. I think it's actually a button. Wait a second, because after a second or two, you should see a smaller button called details. And that's the one you're going to want to click on to selectively remove certain local storage. Because some of it you may want to keep, some of it you may want to clean up. So click on the details button. And then what you can do is there's a little search box at the top. You can search for the website whose data you want to remove. So in Tony's case, where he noticed this was the New York Times. So if you just simply search for nytimes.com, which is their URL in the search box, you should get a result that shows any local data that New York Times is saving on your machine. And that would include things like cookies and image files and app icon or the little icon and those sorts of things. And so then you can select that result and then simply click remove and remove or delete that local data and then click done. Now, keep in mind, if that data was being used by the website, you obviously are going to lose that. You're going to lose the cookies for it. You might have to re-log in. You might have to rebuild that data the next time you visit the site. But that's how you can clean it up. So that's what local storage is all about. Now, if you want to get even geekier, if you're interested in actually looking at the data itself and seeing, hey, what are they actually storing in there? Maybe you're just curious. There actually is a way to do that as well using Apple's Safari developer tools. And the way that you can get at the developer tools is you have to turn it on through the preferences. So again, open up Safari. Go into the Safari menu, go into preferences, and then you're going to click on the advanced tab. And then at the bottom of the advanced tab, you'll see an option that says show develop menu in menu bar. If that's not checked, check that on, and you'll notice in the menu bar, you now have a develop menu. You can close the preferences window, and then what you'll do is you'll go to the site that you want to see the local storage for. And so once again, let's use the New York Times as an example. So you'll go to nytimes.com, and then once the site is loaded, click on that develop menu, and then from the develop menu, there's an option that says show web inspector. Select that, and an inspector window will open up, and there'll be a tab in there called storage. Click on the storage tab, and then on the left-hand side, you'll want to expand the local storage section. So there's a couple different kinds of storage. You could also look at cookies and some other sorts of things, but we want to look at local storage in this case. So expand the local storage section on the left, and then find the nytimes.com item or whichever item is appropriate to the site that you want to see the local storage for. When you select that in the right-hand panel, you'll be able to actually see the data that that site has loaded and stored into local storage. So you'll generally see a little key, and then you'll see the value. It's kind of like a little table. So you have a couple different columns, and you can browse through there and you can look at, hey, what kind of information and data are they storing locally? And then maybe decide, hey, I really don't want that data stored on my machine. I'm going to go back through that other procedure and delete it. But that's what local storage is all about. That's how you kind of look at it, access it, and can check it out. And thank you, Rick, for your question and your email. All right, thing of the moment for this week. I got a cool one for you. It's actually a little product that I found, I think, through an article over on 9to5Mac, or it might have been iDownload Blog, one of those sites. But it's from a company who I have some of their other products. I actually have their Apple Watch stand, which I really like as well, and I think was a previous thing of the moment. But it's called the Spigen Style Ring. S-P-I-G-E-N is the name of the company. And this is a little iPhone accessory. It's a small ring that actually attaches to the back of your iPhone using this little reusable gel pad. And I hate to use this description because I think it's a little more elegant than this, but in a lot of ways, it looks like a little bathtub stopper. It's a little plastic pad that you click on it, or in some cases, I think it kind of looks like those little 3M removable hooks that you might buy for like hanging up stuff. And then it has a little ring on it, and the ring actually has a flattened edge on one side. And you attach it to the back of your phone, and it attaches very securely, but then it gives you a ring that you can actually slide your finger through as you're holding your iPhone to give you a little more secure grip. It's not going to fall out. You're not going to drop it. And it also lets you loosen your grip so you don't have to kind of hold the bottom of the phone so that you can extend your reach. So if you want to use your iPhone with one hand, especially if you have, say, like an iPhone 6S Plus, you can kind of loosen your grip a little bit and you can extend and reach up and reach all of the corners of your screen. So that's cool in and of itself, but then that little ring can actually be flipped out and it's pretty firm. It doesn't flop around. It's actually in there pretty tight. You can flip it out and then you can use that to have a little stand that you can use your iPhone in portrait or landscape mode. So for propping up on your desk or on a table as you're maybe watching a video or a movie or something like that. And then not only that, it also comes with a little dash mount hook that you can put on the dashboard on your car, and then you can use the ring to hook it securely and use it as a car mount. So it has a bunch of different applications. It's completely removable. Like I said, it's a reusable gel pad that's on there, and it even works with cases that are smooth. It does have to be a smooth case, but not completely smooth, because I'm using it actually with my Apple leather case and it works fine. Now, I was a little bit worried about the gel pad and maybe leaving a mark or residue, but so far I've been using it for about a week and a half, 2 weeks, and I haven't had any issues. I've pulled it off. There is a little mark, but it just rubs right out, doesn't leave any residue or any th- everything else, and I've been very happy with it. I think it is a really handy little product. The retail price is $24.99 US, but it's about half that price on Amazon. And, you know, I got mine on a even further discount, so I got it for about $8 US. But currently it's about $12.99, $12 to $13 on Amazon. And it does come in different colors, white, black, or rose gold. The ring itself is always just a silver kind of matte finish to it. I kind of wish they had a, you know, like a gold or a rose gold option for the ring itself, but it doesn't look like they do at this point. Maybe they'll add it at some point. But it's called the Spigen Style Ring. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at mattcast.com. And that's my thing of the moment for this week. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I'd like to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also Text Expander for iOS, along with PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, as well as PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of Smile's great applications at smilesoftware.com. And Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CashFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have a comment for me, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send me audio comments and emails to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. If you want to save on long distance charges and still want to leave a voicemail, I do have a Skype voicemail. My Skype username is the MacCast, so you can call in on there and leave a voice message. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you're on social media, Twitter, Facebook, Google+, you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/themaccast. Or you can join the Google+ community. That's at google.com/plusMaccast. And that's the plus symbol. And you'll find the Google+ community. But that's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.